Welcome to Osteopathy Unplugged. I'm Steve Paulus Dio.
And I'm Bonnie Gintis Dio. We're American osteopathic physicians, and we're a married couple devoted to the practice and the study of osteopathic medicine. We developed Osteopathy Unplugged out of our passion for osteopathy and the recognition that our profession needs a more intimate conversation about who we are and what we do.
Join us as we sit in conversation, talking about the inner and outer workings of osteopathy.
Welcome to episode 42 of Osteopathy Unplugged. Brachial neuritis, a case history, deconstructing and comprehending the work of Dr. Roland Becker. We've decided to take a bit of a diversion in this episode. One of our subscribers, a respected osteopath from France, presented an interesting question. He posed the following query, which we've edited for brevity. He asked, Dr. Becker initially focuses on the shoulder symptoms in this case history, despite the primary cause to be later identified in the sacrum. Given that Dr. Becker's usual approach of being guided by the mechanism rather than by the symptoms, I find it surprising that he did not seem to immediately be drawn to the sacrum. Is this simply part of his clinical process, exploring locally before shifting to a more global listening, or does it reflect something more specific about how he prioritizes attention in certain cases? We thank him for this great question. This question motivated us to devote an entire episode to this case history recorded by Roland Becker D.O. in the book Life in Motion, The Osteopathic Vision of Roland E. Becker D.O. The exact references to this case will be listed in the attached PDF. Our listener, who asked the question, found his inspiration from the writings of Dr. Becker and wanted greater insight into the details of his work and wanted us to use this case history to discuss our interpretations. As you can see, our response to his request is a resounding yes. We're going to answer his question and explore even more in this exciting episode. This case history exemplifies not just Becker's approach and philosophy, but Steve's and my philosophy too. The topics we cover in this episode summarize what we've been talking about in the previous 41 episodes of Osteopathy Unplugged. So here's what we're going to do today. I will first read the entire case history so that you have the context. Then Steve and I will deconstruct Dr. Becker's report in detail, discussing our interpretation and providing insight from our perspectives on osteopathic philosophy and practice. We think you will find our discussion to be interesting and informative. So the title of this chapter in Life in Motion is Guided by the Mechanism. Over a period of many years, I have worked towards the establishment of a one-on-one relationship with the life within me and the life within the patient during treatment. If you take away your personality completely, take away your name, take away everything in your own life, then you are simply a body physiology at work. If I can work on a one-on-one basis to understand what their mechanism is trying to tell me, then I will be guided by the type of pattern and the type of function that is within that patient. The patient's mechanism is literally in charge of things, in charge of that patient. When treating, I am not looking for a pattern within that mechanism. I listen to the mechanism functioning and let it inform me. Here is a clinical case to illustrate that point. A patient comes into the office and he's been having brachial neuritis for over 18 months. He's a tough young man who's also been having a lot of headaches and generally feels miserable. He has all kinds of complaints focused around the brachial plexus region. When a patient comes in with so many complaints, I remind myself that these patients are going to be living for a long time and I don't have to solve all their problems the day they come into the office. We then begin a treatment program. And after two or three treatments, I am aware of the fact that he is not improving. He hasn't made any changes at all. Normally, the body physiology is constantly making changes, and this fact is used to make an assessment at the follow-up visit. Did they or did they not make any changes since the last treatment? The body physiology of the patient gives you something to make a comparison with from treatment to treatment. I am aware of the fact that the potential for change is actively there for every single treatment on a one-to-one basis. So after about the third treatment, this guy is still having the same pain in the same area, and he isn't particularly happy with it. Then I realize that I must be sitting at the wrong end of the lever. All the noise is coming from the upper body, but nothing is having an effect there. He gets no relief. Then I go down and get my hands underneath the sacrum, and the thing is so completely locked that it is impossible for it to go into flexion and extension. To test for motion down there, I get one hand under the sacrum and the other forearm across the ilia. Then as he flexes and extends his feet, I feel the whole pelvis dip as one unit. This means that his sacrum is totally locked down in that pelvis. Otherwise, when he moves his feet, the sacrum and ilia would feel like three units that can function independently. So the sacrum was locked in his pelvis. But where were all the symptoms? Up at the other end. They were complaining up there because they literally had to function against the totally locked pelvis. There was pain, there was neuralgia, there was a pull on the fascia. His symptoms were coming out of a totally locked pelvis that had to be the result of something. So I got to questioning him. It turned out that he owned a sports car and he'd had the engine out on blocks to work on it. But the engine weighed 250 pounds and he weighed 150 pounds. He had lifted that heavy engine over and put it on the blocks. In the process of doing that, in that awkward position, he locked the sacrum right down between his two ilia. It had no other place to go. To treat this, I applied a hold across the pelvis, across the involved tissues, and worked with it, utilizing the tidal mechanism, coming down through there 10 times a minute. When you get a hold of a strain pattern, you put it to work. You grab a hold of the tissues in and around that area and add a little compression. You tease the mechanism, which is automatically going into flexion, extension, internal and external rotation, and follow the strain pattern within that area. I place my hands in the involved area and apply enough compression through my arms or otherwise to make some type of change. In this case, compression on the ilia acts in such a way as to tease them to say, "Hey, wake up, we're working on you." In the case of this young man, after another couple of treatments, I was able to read in those tissues that there was something beginning to function in that 18-month-old problem. The next time he came back, all of a sudden, the pelvis shook, the sacrum went back to work, and he lost all of the symptomatology. The point that I'm trying to make is that we are guided by the living physiology of the patient to go looking for the places we need to work, not where they're having symptoms, but where there is something that can be done to allow their body to train itself to let go of its problems. By constantly reading the situation, we can realize what the tissues did, what we think they might do, and then we can patiently help them to do what is needed. There is a constantly shifting source of information available within the patient. What does that body have that it wants to tell me? How can I tease it to make it speak louder? How can I feel something that's going to happen? And then all of a sudden, I'm aware that it did happen, so I'd better let go and let it go home and get well. It's an organized approach for allowing a human mechanism to make a human change in a living body by a living physician. A lot of things can get done on a one-to-one basis. That's the end of the formal reading of the case history. Okay, Steve, why don't you start the ball rolling?
Okay, first I'd like to say I love our diversions. So many of our episodes are birthed in the mornings while you and I drink coffee, discussing our lives, the world, and osteopathy, of course.
Well, you're my favorite person to apply Dr. Becker's saying, a lot of things can get done on a one-to-one basis.
Yes.
But I also want to give our listeners some credit, too. It's conversations with listeners that often lead us to an unexpected episode topic. I am loving the path we're creating spontaneously through our relationships with listeners. You might see some of that conversation on the Patreon app, but some communications happen in private messages or on Facebook or in emails to us. There are even a few listeners, our osteopathic friends and colleagues, who contact us the old-fashioned way, by phone or even an in-person visit.
Oh, yeah. I love those people, our friends like John McPartland, who just drops by sometimes or calls spontaneously without sending a text message first to set up an appointment for a phone call.
Okay, we're old-fashioned.
Okay, let's not get into cultural stuff.
Yeah.
All right, let's get started here.
Back to our regularly scheduled episode.
This is a great case history from a number of different perspectives. Becker is showing us his unique way of looking at the human body in health and in disease, and it illustrates many of the basic osteopathic principles outlined by Dr. Still. But more importantly, this story demonstrates some of Dr. Becker's main treatment styles. We could devote an entire episode to his interpretation of William Sutherland's work, especially the teachings of adding in compression to the tissues. It's exemplified in this quote from the case history. You grab a hold of the tissues in and around that area and add a little compression. But I digress. We're not going to discuss the approach of adding in compression in this episode, but we will add this interesting topic to our list of future episodes. We're here today to bring this case history into the light of understanding by taking it apart piece by piece. And then, of course, we'll try to put it together all at the end. Bon, do you have any brief introductory comments?
One last piece about the quote you just highlighted. I'm a little uncomfortable with that word, grab a hold, but I know what he means, and we'll be talking about it later, so I can let go of it for now.
You know, Becker was a small-town Michigan dude who, you know, grew up in the before World War II, and I think that that's a little generational.
Yeah.
But that's okay. We can let it go.
Yeah. I just don't want any of our listeners to grab a hold of things.
That's true.
Thinking that he was being rough. He wasn't. Okay. I'd like to set the context for this thought-provoking case history. This case was presented at a Sutherland Cranial Teaching Foundation course in Tulsa, Oklahoma, in the U.S. in 1988. Dr. Becker was 78 years old at that time, close to the end of his many years in practice, although he was still seeing a few patients a week.
What you just said is important for many reasons. First, Becker was 78 years old and still seeing patients. That in itself is incredible. As you and I know, there's a history of hands-on osteopaths still practicing well into their 80s and some into their 90s. My first mentor and close friend, David Musgrave Dio, is 81 years old and still works 5 days a week seeing patients. Last summer, I went to see him in Des Moines, Iowa, and worked in his office seeing patients with him. The last time I worked in his office, I was a second-year osteopathic medical student. It was amazing to see this elderly master at work. I was in awe, and he's my role model for aging into my osteopathic practice as I approach 70 years old.
Well, I have a role model, too. I remember at a Cranial Academy conference one year, there was a gathering of people who had been on Sutherland's faculty, and Ken Little was there. And he had had a stroke and was paralyzed in his right arm and was living in a nursing home, and he still was treating people in the nursing home.
I love it.
Yeah. So with one hand and a forearm, he was amazing.
I've met him a few times. He was an incredibly nice man.
He was.
And
he
filled
was
with a lot of wisdom. He didn't necessarily go outward and teach a lot. He was a quiet, wisdom sort of guy.
Yeah.
Okay, back to my insights around Becker.
There you go.
Second, I appreciate Becker's humility in voicing a key teaching moment for himself. This case is illustrative of something we all learn sooner or later. He was giving those students in 1988 the benefit of his learning in the crucible of the treatment room. I suspect that this clinical vignette occurred earlier in his career and not at 78 years old. Bon, you did some more research into Rollin Becker, and I know you communicated with his main student, Dr. Rachel Brooks. Could you review some of your interesting findings regarding Becker?
Yes. I sent an email to Rachel. She was kind enough to respond. And the following is a long quote from Rachel Brooks. I always love being reminded to go back and read some sections of the Becker books. It's truly amazing how many pearls of wisdom the elder. The episode you've been listening to just faded out because you are not yet a subscriber to Osteopathy Unplugged. Please visit patreon.com/osteopathyunplugged and become a subscriber in order to have full access to the rest of this episode as well as the complete collection.
We have created a set of foundational episodes that will be available for free for everyone. these teachings provide an introduction to osteopathic clinical philosophy. However, the full versions of all episodes are only available through Patreon. Access Patreon through their app or through a browser page. Thank you for listening to Osteopathy Unplugged.
And thank you for your interest in the osteopathic experience.
Until next time, be well, listen deeply, and stay curious.